The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. Hello, Michael Blakely here with Religion in the News. For the next 28-odd minutes, I'll be reading articles from various news services on the subject of religion. The program is generously underwritten by White Memorial Presbyterian Church, to whom thanks. They can be reached at 919-834-3424. From The Economist, first of July 25th, belief in British Columbia. New Canadians are injecting vigor into the country's religious life. Religions gather strength as they cross the ocean. Something strange is happening to Canada's religious profile. As in many Western countries, the share of Canadian citizens who call themselves Christian is in long-term decline. Those who profess no religion, which does not necessarily mean an indifference to the spiritual, is rising. But compared with people born in Canada, newcomers to the country are much more likely to practice a faith, regardless of whether they are devout back in the homeland. Young immigrants are more inclined to engage in regular worship than their parents are. And whatever they believe or practice, new Canadians seem to have a more positive attitude toward religion than longer established ones. A poll commissioned this summer by Cardus, a think tank, found that 57% of immigrants thought religion-based organizations had a good effect on society, while only 36% of Canadians in general held that view. The results of all this are tangible in Vancouver, a port that attracts upwardly mobile migrants from across the Pacific, as well as Canadians from farther east who may be searching for a less conventional lifestyle. The city's Catholic churches are now packed. At popular mass times, it's hard to find room to sit or kneel. But the sermon will probably be in Tagalog, the language of the Philippines. Without the influx of pious Filipinos, it would be a different story. According to Pavel Reed of the Catholic Archdiocese of Vancouver, the church would be closing parishes, as is the case elsewhere in Canada, if it weren't for the new arrivals from a land which is 80% Catholic. 50 years ago, it was common to set up ethnic parishes, but every parish is a Filipino parish now, he says. For decades, British Columbia was the most secular part of Canada. Quebec was a bastion of French Catholicism, now in vertiginous decline. Scottish Presbyterianism made its mark in the ethos of Toronto, and Alberta had an evangelical Christian subculture, along with many others. Compared with all that, the Pacific Coast was a place where people could live and believe much more freely. People from the other side of the Pacific are changing the Vancouver scene. Young immigrants from China often convert to Christianity soon after arriving. Pentecostalism has been described as a form of religion serving the needs of people on the move. The burgeoning of charismatic churches among the ethnic Chinese of the Canadian Pacific seems like a perfect example. For some, joining an evangelical church may reflect a conversion experience or a wish to exercise a religious freedom which was restricted back home. For others, the motives may be more pragmatic, a desire to overcome loneliness and find potential partners for romance, social life, or business. The multiple religious cultures of South Korea, from Presbyterian to Pentecostal, have also become implanted in Canadian soil. Nor is this mainly a Christian phenomenon. Migrants of Hindu, Muslim, or Sikh background often become more pious on arrival in the prosperous but confusing West, and the younger age cohort can be particularly devout. Olivier Roy, a French scholar of Islam, has identified a broad tendency among Muslim families moving to the West. The second generation rejects some features of the old country's culture, but embraces the religion with intensified fervor. In 2015, a pan-Canadian poll by the Angus Reid Institute, a researcher, found that among adults under 50, only 19% of those born in Canada attended an act of religious worship more than once a month. For people born outside Canada, the figure was 59%. Among those over 50, the contrast was less sharp. 25% of the Canadian-born were regular worshippers, while 34% of the newcomers were. Still, by no means all the people who enjoy the beauty and energy of the Canadian Pacific region are God-fearing types. Secularism and antipathy toward conventional religion represents a strong subculture, too. Perhaps it's not a coincidence that one of the most emotive religious secular disputes seen recently in Canada had British Columbia at its epicenter. Trinity Western University is a Christian college where students are expected to sign a covenant that restricts sex to heterosexual marriage. It wanted to establish a law faculty, but the Law Societies of British Columbia and Ontario said they would not accredit the alumni of any such institution, and their stance was upheld in June by the Supreme Court. Somehow or other, well-established Canadians who have become disillusioned with religion and with the behavioral norms that religion tries to impose will have to coexist with newcomers for whom the flame of faith burns bright. That challenge will be especially acute on the West Coast. And from the Associated Press now, July 28th, a U.S. prelate has resigned from the College of Cardinals. Pope Francis has accepted U.S. prelate Theodore McCarrick's offer to resign from the College of Cardinals after allegations of sexual abuse, including one involving an 11-year-old boy, and ordered him to conduct, quote, a life of prayer and penance in a home to be designated by the pontiff until a church trial is held. The Vatican said this on Saturday, the 28th. Francis acted swiftly after receiving McCarrick's letter of resignation Friday evening, after recent weeks have brought a spate of allegations that the 88-year-old prelate, in the course of his distinguished clerical career, had sexually abused both boys and adult seminarians. The revelations posed a test to the pontiff's recently declared resolve to battle what he called a culture of cover-up of similar abuse in the Catholic Church's hierarchy. McCarrick had been removed from public ministry since June 20th, pending a full investigation into allegations he fondled a teenager over 40 years ago in New York City. A man who was 11 at the time of the first alleged instance of abuse says a sexually abusive relationship continued for two more decades. McCarrick has denied the initial allegation. The prelate rose steadily up the U.S. Church's ranks from auxiliary bishop in New York City to bishop in Metuchen, New Jersey, to archbishop of Newark, New Jersey, and then to an archbishop of Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, where the papal ambassador to the United States is based. While most of the scandals involving pedophile clergy have involved rank-and-file priests, some cases involved bishops, and there are a few involving cardinals, including a current case in Australia of one of Pope Francis's closest advisors, Cardinal George Pell, who now faces a criminal trial in his homeland. In the case of Scottish Cardinal Keith O'Brien, accused by former seminarians in 2013 of sexual misconduct, Francis only accepted his resignation after the Vatican's top abuse prosecutor conducted a full investigation 2 years after the first revelations came out. But the Holy See's announcement about McCarrick said that Francis was taking action by isolating McCarrick and ordering penance even before, quote, accusations made against him are examined in a regular canonical trial. In addition, Francis ordered his suspension from the exercise of any public ministry, indicating the Pope was approving the measure already in effect since last month. A Catholic University canon law expert, Kurt Martens, notes that this is the first time an order of penance and prayer had been issued before a church trial had taken place. Since McCarrick is over 80, he is no longer eligible to vote in a conclave to elect a pope. But being, quote, a prince of the church, as cardinals are sometimes called, it is a top honor of the church, and those elevated to that rank are called upon to advise the pope. Bishops have been implicated in the sexual abuse scandals that have stained the Catholic Church's reputation worldwide for decades now, but often for their roles in covering up for pedophile priests by shuffling them from parish to parish and keeping the faithful in the dark about the allegations about clergy whose pastoral duties often bring them into contact with minors. Earlier this month, an Australian bishop became the most senior Roman Catholic cleric to be convicted of covering up child sex abuse. Adelaide Archbishop Philip Wilson was sentenced to 12 months in detention by an Australian court in a landmark case welcomed by some abuse survivors as a strong warning to institutions that fail to protect children. And back to The Economist now of July 27th. America and faith. Sam Brownback makes the right noises about religious liberty. A gathering in Washington, D.C. this week carried a message of hope. When Americans in high places sound the trumpet for global religious liberty, a skeptical world often wonders whether their main concern is the freedom of their own particular brand of faith, or liberty, or in a purer sense, covering all manner of beliefs and non-beliefs. Such questions were in the air this week as President Donald Trump's administration organized an eye-catching diplomatic event in Washington, D.C., a three-day ministerial to advance religious freedom, which brought together foreign ministers and champions of faiths from over 80 countries. The host was a former Republican Senator, Sam Brownback, who is now the State Department's ambassador for religious liberty. Along with other members of the Trump team, including Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, and Vice President Mike Pence, he took office amid concerns, or hopes, from the other side, that he would promote conservative strains of Christianity rather than freedom in general. At a minimum, all these people are on the receiving end of pressure from evangelical lobbies with easy access to the White House. But in fairness to this week's gathering, it gave plenty of attention to the grievances of non-Christian groups, including the Rohingya Muslims of Myanmar and the Uyghur Muslims of northwestern China. Whenever reference was made to the travails of Christians in northern Iraq, it was always emphasized that other ancient faith groups, such as the Yazidis, were suffering similar travails. We were as inclusive as possible because we wanted to include everyone of every faith or of no faith at all, said Mr. Brownback. Religious freedom really, truly is for everyone. It's a right given by God, and it's a beautiful part of our human dignity. Among the showcased speakers was a Uyghur Muslim who said the Chinese authorities were imposing, quote, unprecedented restrictions on his community, including the burning of holy books and the demolition of mosques. Mark Green, head of USAID, the America's Development Agency, used the ministerial to strike a note that was both familiar and contentious. He said that freedom for all kinds of religion was the country's raison d'etre, the basis of its claim to be a shining city on a hill. In slightly different forms, that image from St. Matthew's Gospel was used by John Winthrop, the Puritan preacher who sailed from England to America in the 17th century, and then it was taken up by Ronald Reagan. As Mr. Green put it, some 150 years after Winthrop, that same devotion to religious liberty was seen as so central to the character of a young America that our founders enshrined it as the first item in the Bill of Rights. In other words, the Constitution's First Amendment, which bars the establishment of a religion and guarantees the right to practice any religion. It was more than a pragmatic compromise. It was a message to the world about America's intentions. The organizers of this week's conference had a lot to say about the merits of religious diversity. Mr. Brownback, for example, said, "Tolerance of differences, although that is important, is just not enough. We must move to a place where people genuinely care for and love each other, no matter what our differences." That is a splendid and, in the present moment, rather unusual sentiment. But perhaps the best thing America could do to spread the ideal of amicable diversity in religious and other matters is to practice it at home. And from NBC News now, July 25th, in Istanbul, North Carolina pastor Andrew Brunson was released from prison in Turkey Wednesday after being incarcerated for nearly 2 years there on terrorism charges. Brunson is now under house arrest while the charges remain the same. He faces up to 35 years in prison, his lawyer told NBC. Brunson, age 50, is an evangelical pastor from Black Mountain, North Carolina, who has spent the last 23 years living in Turkey, where he and his wife raised their daughter and two sons. He was running the Resurrection Church in the western city of Izmir when he was detained in October 2016 over accusations he helped individuals the Turkish government says were behind a failed coup. "I talked to his family and they were very happy," said the pastor's lawyer Ismail Sim Hulvert, but added they felt betrayed after the court failed to release him earlier. "He will not be able to leave the house except if he has an interview or hearing in the court. He will be free at home, but he can't do anything else." Halliburtt also said Brunson was in good physical condition, despite the Turkish state news agency reporting that he was released on health grounds. Brunson's daughter Jacqueline Furnari told NBC News in April that he had started to gain back some of the 50 pounds he lost while in detention. "I'm not sure exactly why my dad was chosen," she said at the time. "He's a pawn in a political game between Turkey and the U.S. Local television aired footage of what it said was Brunson being put into a white car and leaving prison Wednesday, surrounded by several other vehicles, led by a police car and motorbikes. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo tweeted afterwards that the U.S. welcomed the news. He tweeted, quote, "But it is not enough. We have seen no credible evidence against Mr. Brunson and call on Turkish authorities to resolve his case immediately in a transparent and fair manner." Halliburtt said he filed a petition for house arrest after the court failed to release Brunson during a court hearing on July 18th. Under the terms of house arrest granted Wednesday, Halliburtt said that authorities will likely keep Brunson's passport and make him wear an electronic ankle bracelet. The Turkish state news agency said the court banned Brunson from leaving the country. There was heightened hope for Brunson's release after President Donald Trump met with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan at a NATO summit this month. Trump has repeatedly called for Brunson's release, stating last week's decision not to release him was, quote, "a total disgrace." "He's been held hostage far too long," Trump tweeted last week. "Erdogan should do something to free this wonderful Christian husband and father." U.S. Senators Lindsey Graham and Jeanne Shaheen met with Erdogan in June, adding to hopes that Brunson would be released. Shaheen said in a statement afterwards that she met with the pastor in prison and asked Turkey's president to release him. Erdogan had previously implied that Brunson's release would be conditional on the U.S. extraditing Turkish cleric Fethullah Gulen, who lives in self-imposed exile in Pennsylvania. The Turkish government has accused Gulen of masterminding an attempt to overthrow the government in July 2016, a charge he denies. Opponents of Erdogan claim he has used the coup to crack down on dissent. About 160,000 people have been detained following the failed attempt, said the UN Human Rights Office in March, and the U.S. official told NBC there's a small handful of U.S. citizens in detention following the overthrow effort. Well, you might be hearing some beeps in the background. The lights are blinking here in the studio at TRRS, and beeps are accompanying them. So if I suddenly disappear, do please forgive me. What have we also got? Oh, yes. The Vatican meets hashtag MeToo. Nuns denounce their abuse by priests. Revelations that a prominent U.S. cardinal sexually abused and harassed his adult seminarians has exposed an egregious abuse of power that has shocked both Catholics on both sides of the Atlantic. But the Vatican has long been aware of its heterosexual equivalent, the sexual abuse of nuns by priests and bishops. Well, you know what? I'm going to go ahead and play the music because I'm not trusting at all that the studio will survive the next few minutes. So, that's all the ability we have for religion in the news at this time. Thanks very much for listening. Sponsored by the White Memorial Presbyterian Church again, who can be reached at 919-834-3424. And Michael Blakely here. I'll talk to you later, I hope.